The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Have John Cozy back again. John does extraordinary writing. We'll talk about his most recent article. He taught for many years. He has been doing a great deal of writing, blogging, etc. since then. He's a retired philosophy professor. He's a terrific guest. I love having him on the program on a regular basis. John has so much to say. He does it in his articles. He does it on this program. Let me just mention two things very briefly before we start. I am a strong supporter of public banking. I feature it in my book titled How Wall Street Fleeces America. The theme of the book is money power in private hands to make more of it at our expense. And the last chapter goes into great detail on public banking, and the title of the chapter is Public Banking, An Idea Whose Time Has Come. Well, it really came a long time ago, and it's long, long overdue. I got an email yesterday. I just want to pass on very briefly. A number of states have introduced bills to establish study groups, or whatever they want to call them, to investigate the possibility of having a public bank in various states. There's only one that has a public bank, and that's North Dakota. We've sure discussed it on this program. It's very much covered in my book. 1919 it began. North Dakota, my goodness, the economic crisis that's ravaged the country for the past 4 years certainly hasn't bothered North Dakota. At the height of the crisis in 2008, North Dakota had the largest budget surplus in its history. Can you imagine that? And while other states were laying people off and raising taxes and doing all those destructive things, North Dakota was so blessed, they rebated a dividend to the residents of the state. How about that? If that alone is the testimony for public banking, I don't know what is. But I got an email yesterday, and I promised the emailer that I would mention it on air, and I want to do it now. Hawaii is the latest state to consider the possibility of establishing a public bank. Well, you know, they're eons away from doing it. Some kind of a proposition that's been introduced. As you can imagine, the banking lobby is fighting it tooth and nail. That's what they do. No holds barred, and they have plenty of money, needless to say. It's all ours. They have plenty of money. All the money they've stolen from us, they want to use to keep us from getting what people deserve. Well, the bill has already been heard. It'll be heard again the end of this month, and I can only hope for the best that maybe North Dakota's bachelor or spinster's day will come to an end. Nearly 100 years later, my goodness, that's a long time to remain unwed. It needs a partner. It needs a lot of partners. I wish the state of Hawaii my best. And if they want to invite me over, I'll be very happy to talk about public banking, especially this time of year. Be delightful to go over there. One more thing. This is a very big day for Syria. They're holding a national referendum on a new constitution. Can you imagine America doing that, or any Western European state doing that? Now, Syria is not a model. Syria has never been a democracy, and it certainly is not one now. But if the promise of this referendum bears fruit, that possibility very definitely exists. The only other country, I'm not an expert on countries holding referenda and letting the public decide on issues as vital as the Constitution, but I do know that Venezuela did it. I wrote about it at the time, over a dozen years ago. They let the public decide if they wanted the Constitution with all the provisions in it. About double the size, or I think even more than double the size of Sirius, because the Sirius, the last I saw, there've been amendments that have enlarged it, but the original document had 157 articles. If I remember the Venezuelan one, it had over 350 or something on that order, and some of them go into a little bit of detail, very, very long and detailed. But the public decided up or down if they wanted it or not. Venezuela does that fairly often. They put big issues to a public referendum vote and let the people decide. Well, that's called direct democracy, and I certainly support that. America's never had it. Western Europe's never had it. And the way things are going, they never will. America has no democracy. We talk about that on this program. Anyway, Syrians are voting. I await the outcome, and my hope is that this Constitution won't just pass. It'll pass overwhelmingly. Well, reports as of, maybe a few hours ago, spoke of heavy turnout in many areas, like the two biggest cities, Damascus and Aleppo. Some of the areas where the killer gangs are ravaging people, the turnout may be a lot less there. And there have been violent attacks, as you might imagine. The opposition, led by Washington, who else, and their, shall I say, non-democratic allies, Saudi Arabia, my goodness, close U.S. ally, Qatar, the other despotic Arab League states, they want no part of democracy. Oh, they use that kind of language and other language related to it. They don't tolerate democracy. Saudi Arabia wants a new day for the Syrians while they shoot their own people in the street protesting for their own rights. Well, they won't get them under this regime unless there's a massive, massive uprising that's sustained. Anyway, that's another topic. But I was delighted to see some reports of massive turnouts. I saw photos, I hope they're accurate, of huge, huge turnouts in Damascus. I would imagine that is accurate because Damascus strongly supports the Assad government. It's a big city, Aleppo as well. So big crowds are turning out. They want to support this thing. I went through it. I didn't read the amendments. There were things that needed to be changed. But I went through the document. It had wonderful things in it. I must say, a lot of the stuff that I read, the U.S. Constitution doesn't have it. Now, you know, fulfillment is a long way from what's proposed. The proof of the pudding is what will happen if this thing passes, and then it goes into effect. There's supposed to be an election in a few months if it passes. Let's see what happens. Anyway, John, these are big things. So much going on. It's big stuff for me. I welcome you to the program and your newest article, another big topic, apologetics of greed. Oh, that's a topic I've taken a look at once in a while, too. Welcome, John.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. Talk about your article and anything else in your mind.
Well, let me talk about something you just said first.
Oh, okay.
The referendum thing. I wrote a piece on this. You know, I've been on the Supreme Court's tail for quite a while. Wrote a number of articles blasting the Supreme Court. And one of the things I pointed out was that the framers made a terrible mistake when they wrote the Constitution. They set up checks and balances, but nobody set up a check on the Supreme Court. And consequently, that leaves the Supreme Court in an absolutely authoritarian position to do anything it wants, and nobody can do anything about it. So I suggested that instead of worrying about individual decisions like Citizens United, et cetera, that people are all up in arms about, that we have a constitutional amendment subjecting Supreme Court decisions to a up and down referendum by the people.
Oh, I love that idea.
Nobody caught on to it but me, I guess.
Oh, I think it's a great idea. I want to go beyond that, John. I mean, anything big like War and Peace, let the public decide on those things.
Oh yeah, yeah, but that's fine. But I was just trying to point out that the only really effective check on the Supreme Court would be to put their decisions up to a referendum, of the up and down referendum by the people, and return the country to the country's authority to the people and take it away from the politicians.
Oh, I absolutely go along with that. And, of course, the Supreme Court can pass something. You know, once in a blue moon, you know, like a broken clock, John, it's still right twice every day. Twice every day.
Yeah.
And once in a blue moon, the Supreme Court gets it right. There were a couple of big decisions during the Bush years where people abused political prisoners were languishing at Guantanamo, and the Supreme Court ruled against the Bush administration. What happened? Well, the Congress did have a check on the Supreme Court. They passed a new law to keep these people.
Well, yeah, but you know, the court... If somebody had questioned it in the law court, it would have gone to the court, and the court probably would have upheld it. So the earlier decision. But the trouble is, you know, with things like Guantanamo, they're such emotional issues that you know, jingoism rules in cases like that, and that's what's going to happen.
Oh, it sure does. Of course, the people at Guantanamo, my guess is virtually every last one of them committed no crime. I think all the ones charged with involvement in 9/11 are totally innocent. They had nothing whatsoever to do with it.
But you got to understand America. Americans don't think that those interned in Guantanamo are people.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I can't get over the ludicrousness of American diplomacy. Susan Rice at the United Nations finds herself in disgust at the Chinese and Russian veto of the Western powers' resolution on Syria. But, you know, there are lots of times, I don't know why the Russians or Chinese didn't point it out. How many times has the entire council voted in favor, even Britain and France voted in favor of resolutions against Israel that the United States has vetoed? Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just embarrassing, the stupidity of what, you know, our people say. And you know, I'm sitting around here watching MSNBC and CNN, and they're all talking, you know, in dismay that President Obama's apology about the Koran burning, which they all label accidental, although nobody knows anything about why it happened, you know, hasn't influenced the Pakistani people. And I say to myself, you know, we've had 10 years of apologies. I mean, when do you realize that apologies don't mean anything if you keep doing the same thing over and over again?
John,
that's not the American way.
It's not the American way. The apologies are so hollow. And I put out an article today on the Koran burning, and my theme was dehumanizing Muslims. That's what it's all about. America declared war on Islam really before 9/11, but that's when the heat really was put on, and literally war on Islam, and you see it over and over again, where Muslims are the target of choice. They get arrested. They haven't committed any crime. I've yet to find one Muslim that I've written about, and I've written about four or five dozen or more, a couple I wrote about recently. They all were framed, entrapped, sting operations. They committed no crime, certainly nothing I found any evidence to prove them of any crime, and yet they jerry-rig the whole system against them. They throw them in prison, innocent people, and the country is supposed to feel safer because we got these bad guys out of commission. And then your Koran burning is almost minor compared to putting innocent people in prison for a lifetime for some of them, you know, charged with terrorism, conspiracy to commit it, all those kinds of things. That's the so-called Oh, there's a shoe bomber, the underwear bomber, a shoe bomber, an underwear bomber, this the Times Square bomber, the underwear bomber, this guy who got on a plane to Detroit and supposedly he had a bomb on board that was caught in the nick of time. They stopped this guy in the nick of time. The whole thing was a setup. He didn't have a bomb, but nobody reported that. He had something the equivalent of a firecracker. It was given to him. He got on the plane. He had no passport. Who ever heard of getting on a plane in a foreign country heading for America without a passport? Britain denied him a visa for whatever reason. Anyway, he got on the plane, allegedly with a bomb, but it wasn't a bomb. And he was set up by the CIA and by Mossad and by India's intelligence agency. And they nailed him, and they threw this kitchen sink at him, and they just convicted him, and they'll put him in prison for life, even though he's innocent. And that's called justice in this country, John. So that makes Koran burnings seem like nothing. But you go over to the Koran burning alone, there have been other incidents. There was a video made of Afghan soldiers, I believe, urinating on the Koran. In Iraq, there were soldiers who used the Koran for target practice. Well, it's not surprising, John, because in training, the soldiers, or Marines, or Air Force, all the branches of service, they are taught to hate the enemy, and they use the most vile names to describe them. In my article, I wrote about a Marine talking about Marine training. Well, in the training, I mean, they get up in the morning, first thing, and they yell a chant, and they end the chant with, kill, kill, kill.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and there's nothing new about that in the military.
Oh, I know.
I've been there, you know. I mean, you have to dehumanize the enemy to be able to kill him.
It happened in Korea. It happened in World War II. It happened in Vietnam, for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure it happened in 1776 or whatever.
Oh, indeed, indeed. I'll go back to the end. I'm sure Alexander the Great used that technique.
Yeah, sure. There are lots of things I don't understand. I don't understand how we think that we can dehumanize these. We can dehumanize Americans to the point where they do this in wars and not expect them to do it when they come home. That I don't understand.
Of course, they do. They do it when they come home. They're taught to be
sure
violent.
Yeah, sure, they do it when they come home, and they'll continue to do it when they come home.
Including against their families, John.
But even worse, you know, to get back to what you were talking about all these setups of Muslims, it just boggles my mind that courts will convict people of attempts to use bombs when they had no bombs.
But they do it.
You know, I mean, a vest filled with stuff that won't explode is not a bomb. You know, we can convict a person for an attempt to use a bomb when he has no bomb. I mean, that just boggles my mind, and how the American people buy into that stuff, I'll never know, but they do all the time. We had a case here in Arkansas where a person bombed a physician's car that he was mad at physician for, whatever. He put a little bomb on the car and blew up a tire and injured the physician. He was convicted of using a weapon of mass destruction for blowing up a tire that injured a person. I mean, you know, to call this a judicial system is absurd. Of course, I pointed out in one of my recent articles that the United States legal system has never been concerned with justice. I pointed that out pretty clearly. You know, it's not concerned with justice at all. And the United States Constitution has nothing in it about the economy, what our economic system the United States is committed to following. All of that... All of the support for the capitalist economic system in the United States comes in the legal code. It's all in case law. The judges have foisted this economy on it, not the Constitution, not even Congress. But you know, case law is case law. Whoever whoever tries to change case law. I mean, it isn't even codified anywhere. If you have to do legal research, you have to go to a book called Shepherds and look up all the cases and read them individually to find out what the case law is. I mean, it's such a jumble that if you wanted to change it, you couldn't. And all of that comes out of the court, which I have called an oligarchy on a number of occasions. But that's the way this country has evolved, and it's in its death throes. Let's face it.
John, I hope it's in its death throes because the destructive.
I was asked to, one of your acquaintances wrote me and asked me to appear on a panel on Progressive Radio Network, and I think some of the things I said turned them off because they withdrew the invitation, and what I said was that. It looked like a discussion of opinions to me. Three different people or four different people, you know, talking what their opinions were about the United States as a police state and Homeland Security and the Patriot Act and all that. And I told the guy I don't write opinion pieces, and I didn't think opinions were worth anybody's attention, not even my own. And then they withdrew the offer, which was all right. I didn't want to do it anyhow.
Oh, my goodness. How do you get an invitation and then have it withdrawn? I can't imagine doing that.
Well, because of what I said, that I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to be put on there to be asked to, tell people what my opinions were, because I didn't want to do that. And I left myself open to being, to the invitation being withdrawn, and that was fine. I was glad to do that because I do not want to ever appear on a show where opinions are the subject of discussion. I mean, that doesn't interest me one bit. But what I meant to say was that I was thinking about that. I thought I was going to be on the show, so I was thinking about it since I hadn't really thought about that subject very deeply. And it came to my attention that, when a country's government starts being repressive, starts spying on people, taking people's privacy away from them and all that kind of stuff, they tell you that they're trying to, preserve the country or, just make the country secure. But a government only does that kind of thing after it has lost its trust in the people. We all know that the people of America have lost their trust in the government. I mean, that's pretty clear. But when you realize that people don't spy on people they trust, if you're going to spy on people, you don't trust them anymore. And so when the government starts spying on Americans, you have to conclude that the American government doesn't trust its own people. When Homeland Security and the TSA checks every single passenger who gets on an airplane as a possible terrorist, the government has lost its trust in the American people. The people, they're afraid that the people do not agree with anything the government is doing, and they're not going to let them voice that opinion. So what's happened in America and in other places in the world, like in Europe, for instance, when the people trying to work out a bailout tell the Greeks that they can't even have an election, can't put anything up to a vote of the people, a referendum. They don't trust the people of Greece when they do that. I mean, democracy is being thrown out the window because the people in charge don't trust what the people are going to say. And that's the situation it seems to me that we're in at the moment, that is very troubling. Yet when Americans realize, as they have, that they don't trust the government, they have no reason to trust the government, when they realize that the government in turn does no longer trust them, then I think the attitude that Americans have about what's going on in America would be entirely different. But nobody's making that point. Nobody's trying to point that out, and I am right now.
Well, I think it's an important point, John. And, of course, most people in America just don't put their minds around big issues like this. They're too focused in their own personal lives. That's important. You need to be focused on your personal lives. But then they spend most of the rest of their time thinking about extraneous, that are diversions, and it pulls them away from these big issues that touch their lives directly, and they don't even realize it. And we see the mess we're in. How could a government get away with the crimes that the American government gets away with all the time? Egregious crimes, the worst ones I know committed by any country. Nothing approaches the crimes of America. And the American people are asleep and indifferent, and they simply don't pay any attention to this. I mean, the last time we had a good war protest that was sustained, oh, we had it for a while for the Iraq War, but it waned and never came back. The last good one we had was Vietnam, and the big difference then was we had a draft.
That's right.
People had to go into that meat grinder when they didn't want to go. Now a lot of damn fool yum kids volunteer to go in. Well, I know it's tough to find a job, but is it worth getting your head blown off just to be employed? And the benefits these kids are promised, well, they're lies. Most of them never get them. Education, health care. I mean, they just dump these kids like trash. They use them as cannon fodder, and then they just dump them. They don't care about them. And bring on the next crop of cannon fodder. And this is the way America fights its wars. Also makes promises to undocumented Latinos. Well, you know, we'll put you in the queue for a green card if you'll allow us to send you overseas to get your head blown off. And if it happens, we'll still leave you in the queue. And these kids volunteer for this?
We've gone back to the 16th century. And of course, I've said that about a lot of things about America in the pieces I've written. But now armies are mercenaries. Not only are armies mercenaries, they're assassination squads. War is being fought by assassination. This is 15th, 16th century stuff. Western civilization has gone backwards in the last 100 years, considerably backwards.
John, it sure has, and I love the old Gandhi quote when he was asked what he thought of Western civilization, and he said he thought it was a good idea.
Oh.
I haven't seen any around.
No. I know why it's happening because. Well, let me put it this way. I read an article the other day where some people are questioning the studies that show that American education system is worse than the education systems in many other parts of the world, blah, blah, blah. And they were arguing the statistics about it and where, you know, how they were calculated and all of that. And there may be some merit to that kind of argument. But I laughed and I said, you know, if you want to prove that the American educational system is bad, all you have to do is listen to Rick Santorum. I mean, that's all you have to do. And Mitt Romney I don't know what to say about the guy from Georgia. Sometimes I think that maybe there might have been some hope for the educational system when he became a college professor and didn't receive tenure, got kicked.
Gingrich
out of the Congress, and he couldn't receive tenure at a backwoods college in Georgia.
Newt Gingrich?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. You know, so here we have this backwoods. This guy who couldn't even get tenure at a minor college in the state of Georgia, which is hardly an academic mecca, and then he goes to Congress and he gets kicked out of Congress, and now he's running for president. Wonderful. That's the American American dream, if I ever heard of it.
It sure is. All of the Republican candidates, well, the three except for Ron Paul, they want to bomb Iran.
Yeah.
They're angry that they think Obama is helping Iran get nuclear weapons.
Yep.
I mean, and people believe this kind of stuff. I must say, I don't think Gingrich is stupid. He's just a racist and a warmonger and all the rest. Santorum literally has sawdust between his ears if he has anything. He's an ignoramus. I mean, a real ignoramus besides a racist.
My point in telling people, if you want to know how bad the American educational system is, don't look at the kids in grade school or look at the damn graduates.
Well, I certainly agree, John. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back. We'll dive right back into this again.
Okay.
We could keep this going all afternoon.
I want to get to my paper, though.
Oh, I do want to get to your paper. We will be right back. Welcome back on with John Cozy. Oh, we're talking about big stuff domestically in America, world issues. And John, indeed, let's jump over to your article, The Apologetics of Greed. One thing we both know, it sure is headquartered in America.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's headquartered in America. We may have imported it, but we took the company over.
We didn't originate the idea, but they sure perfected it.
If I can, you were talking about private banking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that would help a lot. There's no question about it.
Public banking.
That would help a lot. There's no question about it. And if you're not going to change the system, change parts of it that'll help, and that would be one of them.
That's the biggest part, John. I'll make one comment about that. There is no power greater than money power, and the old Rothschild banking predator families from the 19th century, at least two of them, I think, said just about the same thing.
Well, Rothschild said it.
Well, there were several Rothschilds, but
yeah,
I think a couple
of the
family
one
members.
Of the early Rothschilds said it.
Oh, yeah, Baron. One of
yeah.
Baron. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the famous statement was, give me control of a nation's money and I don't give a damn what laws they make.
Yeah, well, sure, and that's exactly what's going on in Europe. You know, they gave the bankers control of the nation's money, and now everything's... Everything's going to hell, and the people are being. And people in Greece might just as well be walking the plank into the Aegean Sea.
That's right. I wrote a number of times about Greece, and I said the Greek people have three choices: they can either starve, they can leave, or rebel. There's nothing else.
Yeah, and I don't know why. I don't know why the Greek people aren't attacking individual legislators. I mean, going. I'd be the last one in the world to advocate violence, but I don't know why they haven't kidnapped Papandreou and made him walk down the streets of Athens naked. That's what I would do.
Now he was the fired prime minister.
Yeah.
And an unelected banker. I mean, the banker who replaced him, his name sounds almost the same from Papandreou to Papademos.
Yeah, and I've nicknamed him Papa Demon.
Papa Demon is right.
Yeah, but what bothers me is all these guys are going to the legislature down there every day, and they're arguing and passing this stuff. You know, I don't know why people aren't dragging them out of their houses at night and stripping them naked and tarring and feathering them and making them walk down streets, you know, publicly and endure the wrath of stone throwing and egg throwing and everything else. I mean, that's the kind of thing you have to do to change that.
That's
you know,
right,
you're
John.
Not going to get it by burning down buildings in Athens while the legislature is in session and guarded by police, who I don't understand anyhow, because they're going to take the brunt of this all this austerity too.
You're on the wrong side, John. I say
yeah.
that a lot, and I say that protests are a waste of time. We see it all the time, burning down buildings does no good. You've got to go after the heart of the problem, the cancer. These politicians, and John, I must say, I fervently oppose the death penalty. But I'll make an exception when it comes to bankers and corrupt politicians who literally destroy their countries and their own people to see that they get paid first. I will make an exception for them.
Well, you know, that's not my solution. I wrote a paper about this too a little while ago. But what we have to do is come up with a way of shaming them to the point where they can't, they get no benefit from what they've done. You know, confiscate their assets. Don't allow anybody to employ them. Let them live on the streets like the people that they've evicted from their houses. That strikes me as a much more effective kind of punishment than the death penalty. Death penalty is easy for those guys. They don't care.
The death penalty is easy. You know, I absolutely agree with that, because the ideal solution for people like this and Bush and Obama and all these types of people in the predatory countries and the corporate predators, putting them in the gas chamber or something is too easy. My preference would be send them to the coldest spot in Siberia to crack rocks in the winter. Send them into boiling sun in the summertime to do the equivalent of that. And keep them on bread and water the whole time.
Yeah, I favor Antarctica. I think they ought to go to Antarctica.
I would say that sounds fine. And boy, agreed certainly defines what they do. One more comment on Greece, John. The way these bailouts work, in Greece, it's the worst any place. But just imagine, Greece, the politicians vote to take a so-called bailout. Well, you know, I don't know why they just don't hand the money to the bankers, because that's what they're going to do this time. They're going to put the money in escrow on the latest deal.
Yeah, why doesn't the European Commission that's dealing with this just take the money instead of giving it to Greece, give it to the bankers, pay off the debt, and nail it?
Well, they're not going to pay off the debt.
Pay off whatever they do of it, you know.
Well, the more they borrow, the higher the debt goes, and they fudge the numbers. The real debt is double the official number, but they go through this charade. The legislature passes another bailout to help Greece's payment problem. Why bother giving them any money? Just take this amount of money that the Eurozone and the ECB want to hand out. Just write a check directly to the bankers.
Yeah.
Don't pass it through the Greek people. Just send it right off to the bankers. Make it simple.
Yeah, well, that's what we did. That's what our government did. We send it off to the bankers.
We sure did. We keep doing it. And
the
Federal Reserve is also bailing out European bankers to the tune of in excess of $1 trillion.
What people don't realize, you know, and Americans don't realize it, the American media don't point it out, or don't realize it, or don't point it out, is, you know, all these central banks, they're not governmental entities. They're banker entities. They're all owned by conglomerates of banks, and their whole purpose is to protect the banking system. And that's exactly what the Federal Reserve does every time it acts. It's attempting to protect the banking system.
And it's not even secret, John. You can go into the Federal Reserve documents, and you'll find out that the Federal Reserve is owned by the member banks in the 12 districts, and the New York district is called the Mother District, where Wall Street is.
Well,
they own one out of 12 districts, and they own a majority share. So who owns the Federal Reserve? They don't like to talk about the individual names, but we know them. J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, you know, all the ones that we've grown to love.
Rockefeller.
Rockefeller, absolutely. Well, J.P. Morgan is Rockefeller's bank. He's getting old now. He's 93, 94. I will not be mourning the day he goes, but, you know, there'll be another guy like him to take his place.
Sure. You know. I often laugh. You know, you read about what Egyptian pharaohs did after they assumed office. You know, they quite often had their architects or whatever go all over Egypt and chisel away the name of the previous pharaoh.
The Ministry of Truth.
You know, I don't know why we don't do that. I don't know why we don't take some chisels to Rockefeller Center, you know, and name it something like Slumlord Emporium.
Oh boy! Well,
you know, but that's since I'm not in favor of any kind of violence. I really think that the solution to greed is to vilify these people and shame them. You know, pick their pictures every day and see their fathers or their grandfathers being vilified. You know, the boyfriends of their daughters realize that they're marrying into this atrocious family and things of that sort. And I think that would be far more effective than killing people. I really do.
I'm all in for peace, or the drug industry, or the auto industry. You know, they all need me. They can funds, but you know, they get intertwined in different ways from their businesses. So, and of course, the big financial institutions, they control all markets, the financial commodity, stock markets, they control them all. And listeners may recall, was it, 2010?
You know, the thing that astounds me is that nobody seems to have realized that if you allow private individuals to accumulate wealth like we have, then every government can be bought. And the private individuals who have that wealth will corrupt everything they touch. And there's only one solution to that, of course, and that is do not allow private individuals to accumulate that kind of wealth. That's the only way of beating the system. And, wealth really should not belong to people. It should belong to societies.
Well, I spoke about somebody important to me, John, and I wrote about her. I mentioned her at the top of my program yesterday, Garda Gista, who very sadly passed away of breast cancer a bit ago. And she believed in, she had a website, World Proud Assembly, and she believed that the world's resources should be distributed for everyone to benefit. Everyone should benefit from these resources. They shouldn't be skewed.
The wealth of the earth ought to belong to all people. Not only all people. I mean, some of it belongs to some of the animals that climb the forests, this business of trying to solve problems by killing the opposition, that's barbarous.
It's barbarous, and it doesn't really accomplish anything.
No, it never does, because you know there'll be. You just make the friends of the opposition angry when you do that. You know, I ask myself, how in the world, given what's going on in Afghanistan, you know, where Afghani security forces, whenever they get an opportunity, you know, kill their American trainers. How in the world anybody in this country is stupid enough to think that we can train an Afghan security force that'll be on our side? I mean, that is so stupid. And yet, you know, that's what we're doing.
Why should they be on our side, as you
say,
John?
Why should they be on our side? Precisely.
We destroy their country. We kill people important to them. I mean, literally, we kill innocent civilians every single day. Burning a Quran is really a non-event compared to the terrible death and destruction that goes on.
Yeah, I know. You know, Hillary Clinton will complain about how many people are dying daily in Syria. How many people are dying daily in Afghanistan? I mean, debt, and for how long?
Exactly.
I realize that there's a fundamental problem in America. The truth has somehow or other been buried. Nobody seems to be truthful in this country anymore. It's back to where I was a few minutes ago. Since nobody is truthful anymore, nobody trusts anybody. The government doesn't trust people, and people don't trust the government. I mean, it's one big lie. And our foreign policy is one big lie.
Time, John. You know, when you're fighting one war, you lie about that war. And now we're fighting multiple wars. So we lie about all of them. And it's always couched in language, liberating people, bringing a humanitarian mission, responsibility to protect, all of that garbage. And you wrap it all up in a ball, and it's nothing but a big lie. Every single time, all of it, Obama not only is as bad as Bush, he really is a lot worse than Bush. He's done things that Bush never would have attempted, but he's done it, and he keeps lurching from one thing to another. I don't have any doubt, John, that war is planned against Syria, unless the Syrian people somehow are able to overcome this by what they do. A majority of Syrians support, but that's not good enough. The majority of Libyans supported Gaddafi. Sure didn't help, but Gaddafi.
You know, the Muslim fundamentalists are being smart. You know, they're coming out to support the Assad's opposition, the demonstrators. You know what they're trying to do, don't you? They're trying to take over that movement so that if the United States does get in, or the Western powers does get in and supports the opposition so that the opposition overthrows Assad, the Arab fundamentalists will be in a position to take over the revolution. And that's a good move.
We know there are two oppositions, John. There is the outside group, the Syrian National Council, and the so-called Free Syrian Army. They're the violent group. They want to violently overthrow the government. There's an internal opposition. Assad doesn't attack them. They're nonviolent. They want no outside interference, and they're completely shut out of the discussions about changing the system in Syria. The so-called, the Arab League states, Washington, the European countries, they shut these people out entirely. And they also want a different system, but they don't want foreigners to come in and meddle in their affairs.
They want
to handle them on their own, and that is their legal right.
Yeah, sure. It reminds me, go back to Libya. You know, we had all this NATO support of this Revolutionary Council or whatever the heck the hell they call it, and what happened? Nothing. You know, NATO left and the council is powerless.
It's powerless, and the country is ravaged by violence.
Independent armies are popping up, you know, all over the place. I mean, that was hardly a revolution.
It was no revolution.
Deposition. They deposed Gaddafi. That's all. Left the place, you know, with the chair empty.
John, Libya was peaceful and calm. Western powers intervened, and they sent these killer gangs in. It started small early last year, and it's building, and then the bombing started. But Libya was very calm and peaceful, so much so that Gaddafi could ride down one of the main drags of Tripoli, the capital, in an open car, waving to the population. My goodness, I mean, if somebody wanted to take a pot shot at him, there he was. I saw videos of him doing exactly that, and there were big crowds lined along the sides of the road cheering him. But
yeah,
you never heard that reported.
There was no popular revolution. I mean, anybody with any sense you know, can look at that and say there was no popular revolution. I'm always, revolutions are funny sort of things. And you have to be skeptical about any revolution whose leader is some expatriate who's left the country and trying to get back in.
Somebody who is invented, John. You know, somebody that the people know nothing about this person. Well, that's what happened in Libya. You got this National Transitional Council. A bunch of defectors, outsiders, certainly not leaders of the country. They sold out their country. And the same idea is going on in Syria.
Syria,
and,
that's right.
They'll get around to Iran.
Well, I hope not.
Well, I mean, we're talking about possibly World War III if they start attacking all these countries.
Yeah. Okay, let's get to my piece. We have about 10 minutes left.
We're getting near the end of the hour. Say a few words about your article.
Okay, my piece was very simple. Globalization, economists make the claim that globalization ultimately lifts all boats. And I looked at the case of Bangladesh, which I knew a little bit about. And we're after 30 years, it hasn't lifted any boat. And I said to myself, well, what went wrong there? And it occurred to me that the whole economic activity that Western economists utilize of making models and then claiming that, you know, put this model into effect, you'll get this kind of result. And the models look logical. They do. But I pointed out that every model is created by leaving things out. I call it subtracting. I had an argument with one of the economists who blog it's a year or so ago now. He said these were abstractions, and I said, no, they weren't. They were subtractions. But that's not a case of being people not understanding the language. But what they leave out stuff that the model doesn't consider, and then the stuff they leave out turns the result of the model upside down. And the situation was that this factory was built in a place in Bangladesh, and the American company that built it thought it would be a good propaganda move to have one of the employees of the factory come over to America and see the results of the factory's products and how they were sold and that sort of thing. They brought her over here. Unfortunately, it didn't work out like they wanted, because when she saw how much they were charging for the products that these Bengalis were making, and how little the Bengalis were being paid for it, she started raising hell, and they sent her back to Bangladesh real quick. But her point was that when the factory was opened and people went to work, the rest of the town, the vendors and the landlords especially, raised all of their prices, so that the people who were working in the factory barely made any money, any real money, because anything they got in their paychecks was taken back by the vendors and the landlords who had raised their prices, so that the people who were working in the factory were working for free. And they were doing the work, and the landlords and vendors in the community were getting all the money. And not only that, all the people in the community who were not employed by the factory and not getting this extra pay were considerably worse off than they had been before the factory had been built, because now they had to deal with the higher prices that the landlords and vendors were charging. So what turned the model upside down wasn't the model. The model was fine, but there was externalities that the model didn't consider, which was what the vendors and landlords would do after the factory started. Because if the vendors and landlords had not raised their prices, then the people working in the factory would have been better off. But it turned out that they're not better off. Even after 30 years, they're not better off, because the economic model can't take into consideration all of these externalities that can affect the situation. Although I wrote the article in a way that it features what happened in Bangladesh. That happens everywhere where globalization takes place. The increased money that the employees make who didn't work before is simply taken away from them by other aspects of the society who raise their prices and other things that the people have to pay for.
John, working people are always the ones who come out on the short end.
And they get, well, as the bank, the Bengali woman said, she said, you know, we're working for free. The landlords and vendors are getting all the money. And I wanted to generalize that case, and I don't know whether I did it well or not, but I wanted to generalize that case. That's always going to be the case with economic models. You can't take everything into consideration in an economic model. The economic model predicts so-and-so, provided that all the externalities stay the same as they were afterward than they were, you know, beforehand. But they never stay the same, so that all economic models have to fail perforce. There's no question about it. What economists do is simply provide excuses that businesses can use to rob the people, and I call that the apologetics of greed.
It's pretty disgusting, John, and it's been a good while, but I wrote once or twice about Bangladesh myself, and I wrote about, the business of dismantling big ships. And the job is so dangerous that it literally kills people. There are accidents that happen all the time. The workers have a shelf life. You can't have a job like that and last beyond so many minimal number of years, and they end up with disabling injuries, or they're killed, and they get horrible pay. And these are the kind of jobs. I mean, brutal exploitation of these people, and there are other cases where the abuse of workers to conform to the regimentation they have to live and work under. Just outrageous stuff. Would globalization help them? The hell it's helped them. It's made their lives miserable.
Yeah, I had a tete-a-tete with an economist about that, who claimed that, well, these people were all better off because now they were working and they hadn't been working before, and that was better than not working at all. And I said to him, wait a minute. I said, that's just like arguing that giving a person tuberculosis is better than giving him cancer.
That's so true, John. We're just about out of time.
What dismays me about it is that people are too dumb, you know, to realize just a simple thing. Like I said, you know, what you're arguing is that giving people tuberculosis is better than giving them cancer. And yeah, that's true, but who the hell wants either one?
And people don't think about this stuff at all. John, we're out of time. Oh, the hour goes by so fast.
That's called progressive.
Progressive indeed. Oh, maybe one day we'll get a topic to discuss that we really can have great joy about. I sure don't see any on the horizon, but I look forward to one day to that happening. John, I look forward to getting you back next month.
Okay, good day, Stephen.
Okay, John, many, many thanks. And do join us every Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Weekend, Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit for terrific guests like Jack Rasmus yesterday in The Economy, John Cozy today on a whole range of topics, and get an all-star lineup next week. Don't miss it. Make it a regular habit.